Kathy, bringing you the commercial news for Tuesday, the 9th of December. Looking at the front page, the first article, documentary tells the story of a hometown boy by Chad Dare. It's not Hollywood or New York City, but for one night, downtown Danville had its place in the entertainment industry. As part of the Fisher Fest celebrating the life and legacy of Dick Van Dyke, hundreds of people braved chilly conditions to line the block around the Fisher Theater, waiting to see the world premiere of Dick Van Dyke's 100th celebration. "It's our honor to be the first ones to see this documentary in its entirety," said Danville Mayor Ricky Williams, Jr. And State Senator Paul Faraci presented a state proclamation celebrating the documentary to Fisher Theater Executive Director Ashton Greer. The celebration actually started with a flash mob, dressed like chimney sweeps from the movie Mary Poppins, performed to an array of songs from the movie. They were joined by Marty Lindvall, who was dressed like Mary Poppins, who then led more than 500 fans in singing Happy Birthday. The documentary touched on the beginning for Dick Van Dyke at Danville High School, and it noted that Dick wasn't the funniest man in his family. That honor belonged to his father, Cookie Van Dyke. In his illustrious career, Van Dyke has won an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony Award, and he starred in movies like Mary Poppins, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, along with the television program, The Dick Van Dyke Show. "I was so impressed with the rich history. I learned so much about Dick Van Dyke than I had already known," said John Coleman of Danville. "Being born and raised in Danville myself, I have such a dreamer's heart and the acting bug. Seeing that people from Danville made it was really inspiring. He is famous and known all around the world, and he is from little old Danville." That was a sentiment from a lot of people that attended Saturday's documentary. "I thought it was a beautiful, wonderful story," said Dave Kitzman. "I've always admired him, but I learned a lot about who he was and some of the amazing stories of his life. Admittedly, not everyone in attendance knew that Van Dyke was from Danville. I was a fan of his before I actually knew he was from Danville," Coleman said. "I used to watch him on television, and I would dream about Hollywood. Then one day, someone told me that Mr. Van Dyke was from Danville, and I didn't believe them. But I got to meet him at the Danville High School about 10 years ago. The man is so warm and gentle. He made me feel warm like I've always known him." Ariel Hogg of Fairmont noted that it is not just the people of Danville that adore Van Dyke. "Obviously, it was great to see the Danville stuff touched on in the film and see Dick's life, but some of the stuff was new to me," she said, noting that Mary Poppins was her favorite movie as a child. "Everyone throughout the world adores Dick Van Dyke. It's pretty special to see that." Coleman added this documentary solidified and reinforced the thoughts on Dick Van Dyke. "He made such an impact on everyone, but especially the youth," he said. "He didn't just become somebody. He also found a way to help other people. You could see his impact. Everyone in the documentary had so much joy when they talked about him." While Van Dyke wasn't able to attend this weekend's festivities, which included the showing of Bye Bye Birdie, the comic, and Mary Poppins on Sunday, he was able to see most of it through social media, including sharing some of those insights, highlights, on his social media feed. Van Dyke's actual 100th birthday is this Saturday. This next article is mostly pictures. It's called Deck the Halls. Nearly 70 floats and groups took part in the 2025 Night of Lights Parade in downtown Danville. The theme on this year's event was Decked the Halls, and the parade was organized by the City of Danville's First Friday's event series. The next event is Fire and Ice at the Palmer Arena from 5 to 8 p.m. on January 2nd. This picture shows three ladies dressed up, which Whitney Michelle, Kennedy Price, and Brianna Maloney were wishing everyone a Merry Christmas as they rode a float sponsored by Beth's Big Four in the 2025 Night of Lights. And then there's a picture of the Grinch sitting on a snowplow as part of a float for Danville Township during the 2025 Night of Lights Parade in downtown Danville. Jordan Forez, the 2025 Miss Georgetown Fair Queen, rode in the back of a convertible during Friday Night of Lights Parade in downtown Danville. Forez will compete in January with 74 other queens for the title of Miss Illinois County Fair. And then Spotless the Dog walked the parade route Friday night at the Night of Lights Parade in downtown Danville as part of the Keep Vermilion County Beautiful. This next article is also on the front page. Baby and Mom Rescued from Mobile Home Fire in Georgetown by Christy Jankowski. Quick thinking by the Georgetown ambulance crew and police officers got a mom and her baby out safely while a trailer was engulfed in flames next door. Rusty Berry, the Georgetown fire chief, said that around 1:55 p.m. on Friday, his crew was alerted to a trailer on fire at 107 East 16th Street in Georgetown. Berry said on his way to the fire, "Once I saw the smoke myself. When I was coming out of Westville, I called for Catlin, and then I dropped the box alarm." Berry added that doing so gets more mutual aid to help put the fire out. Tanya Cheeseman, EMS's assistant coordinator with the Georgetown Ambulance, said they are automatically dispatched when there is a fire. She said when they arrived, it was obvious the fire had already destroyed quite a bit. "The fully engulfed trailer was pretty much a goner," Cheeseman said. "There was no way that we could even get to it to see if there was anybody inside who may have been a trap because there were flames coming out on four sides." However, immediately, first responders noticed that while the house next door to the one on fire was not, the flames were getting very close. She noted the siding of the house was melting from the heat. With only two front doors facing the fire and no rear exit, escape routes were limited. A man appeared looking for people inside. That's when both Cheeseman and her EMT colleague, Amy Morgan, learned a woman and a baby were still trapped in the house. The mom put the baby in a baby carrier, and they tried to get her out the kitchen window at first, but it was too small for the carrier, she said, and the mom tried to use the bedroom window as a means of escape, but she could not open it. "She tried, and it wasn't opening," Cheeseman said, "so that's why they went around to the kitchen, a smaller window, to get the baby out that way. That didn't happen." Cheeseman and Morgan remained calm. "So then I told them go back to the bedroom window and we would just bust it in," Cheeseman said. So police pretty much with their fists started busting the glass, but Cheeseman has other plans. "Let's take this toy that's lying on the ground and start busting through the glass." So that's what I did. Once the glass was broken enough, she said, that's when she passed the baby through and the mother got out as well. She said she thinks the baby was somewhere around 1-year-old Morgan, added that the Georgetown police officers were a huge help. "There were several officers who were there as soon as we got there," Morgan said, adding that she thinks the toy she used to break the glass was a scooter. "We broke the window, and then the Georgetown police actually came in and finished getting all the glass out as she was handing the baby to my partner and me," Morgan said, "and then she got out right after that." Chief Berry added that while the whole event is something they train for, it certainly is not something they deal with daily. "It's pretty huge. As I said, that's something that you don't see every day," Berry said about the dramatic rescue. "And they were fighting the fire and rescuing people in sub-zero temperatures with ice and snow coating the roads and everything. We work hand in hand, you know. We're a district, and it's pretty good," Berry said. "The mutual aid that we have on both sides of us is great." Berry said fire departments from Chrisman, Catlin, Westville, and Sidell responded, along with the Georgetown Fire Department, ambulance, and police responded to the fire. "There's no known cause for the fire. Berry said it is currently under investigation and has displaced the family in the trailer that caught on fire, which took around 2 hours to put out on Friday afternoon. The other family was able to return to their home with siding damage from the fire next door." And on page 2, we have some community briefs. Schweitzer holds Toys for Tots drive. State Representative Brandon Schweitzer, Republican from Danville, is hosting his first ever Toys for Tots drive this holiday season. New and unwrapped toys for children can be dropped off at Schweitzer's office, located at 3821 North Vermilion Street, Suite 5 in Danville, until December 9th. All toys collected will go to the Danville Toys for Tots chapter. The Toys for Tots organization does a tremendous job of spreading Christmas cheer year in and out, and I am happy to support their mission, Schweitzer said. "This holiday season, I encourage everyone who is able to give to this great organization to support local children." Covington Church hosts concert. The Covington United Methodist Church, located at 419 Washington Street in Covington, will present its annual Christmas concert at 5 p.m., that's Eastern, on Sunday, December 14th, with pipe organ music by Tom Fricke. The concert will begin with the church handbell choir. Featured will be Grammy-nominated Ernie Couch and Revival, a gospel group that has been traveling across the U.S. for 3 generations. A reception will follow the concert. There is no admission charge, but a free will offering will be taken to help defray costs. Barbershop Group holds a Christmas benefit concert. The Danville Barbershop Chorus will be recalling Christmas memories at their annual Christmas benefit concert. The concert is set for 3 p.m. on Saturday, December the 13th, at St. James United Methodist Church, located at 504 Vermilion Street in downtown Danville. Special guests will be the Westville High School Chorus under the direction of Ellen Howie. In addition to their numbers, the two choruses will combine to sing Snowy Day. and there will be audience participation, singing a number of familiar Christmas carols led by the chorus. Tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for children K through 12. Tickets can be purchased from the Barbershop Chorus members or at the door on the day of the concert. Proceeds from the concert will benefit Wreaths Across America, an organization that strives to honor those buried at the National Cemetery on the Ileana VA grounds in Danville by placing a wreath on their grave for Christmas. This headline, Donation Enhances WorkSource Programs, and there is a picture that accompanies this article. Members of the First Farmers Bank and Trust presented a $7,100 check to WorkSource. Pictured from left to right are Richard Cloth, Director of Program Development, Brandy Tothero, FFBT Hoopston Branch Manager, Jordan Sharp, Development at WorkSource, Amanda Bolin, Oakwood Branch Manager, and Brandy Seabaugh, CEO of WorkSource. First Farmers Bank and Trust has provided a $7,100 sponsorship to support WorkSource, a Danville-based nonprofit that offers employment, education, and daily living programs for individuals with disabilities. WorkSource operates a day program that serves approximately 100 people each weekday, 70% of whom live in group homes. The organization helped its participants, referred to as consumers, develop pre-vocational skills for workplace success, along with essential life skills such as cooking and home safety. Through its programming, WorkSource facilitates an average of 18 job placements each year while maintaining a structured classroom-based environment that encourages independence and personal growth. The facility has been recognized by the state inspectors as one of the best of its kind in Illinois. First Farmers sponsorship will help fund the organization's ongoing program needs, including the development of its on-site general store, which provides hands-on learning opportunities for participants. In recognition of the partnership, WorkSource plans to display signage naming the area the First Farmers General Store. The donation aligns with First Farmers Bank and Trust's commitment to supporting organizations that strengthen local communities and improve access to opportunity, particularly for low and moderate income individuals and families. For more information about First Farmers Bank and Trust, visit www.ffbt.com or follow First Farmers on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. In the next page, Chicago man charged with first-degree murder. A Chicago man was arrested Monday and charged with first-degree murder in conjunction with a November 29th shooting at Scooter Bar in Danville. According to the release from the Danville Police Department, officers with the Danville Police Department's problem-oriented policing unit observed a 30-year-old male they recognized as John Tell J. Robinson from Chicago. Officers were aware that Robinson was wanted on an outstanding warrant for first-degree murder and unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon in connection with the shooting death of 30-year-old Tevin J. Patton of Joplin, Missouri. Robinson was also wanted on a separate outstanding parole warrant through the Illinois Department of Corrections. Upon seeing the officers, Robinson fled on foot. After a brief foot pursuit, POP unit members and patrol officers apprehended Robinson without incident as he attempted to hide in a tree line. He was taken into custody and transported to the public safety building for processing. Robinson is the second individual to be charged in this shooting, joining Trayvon M. Lake, 30, of Danville, who was arrested and charged on November 29th. The investigation into this incident is ongoing, and anyone with information is urged to contact the Danville Police Department at 217-431-2250, our Vermilion County Crime Stoppers, 217-446-TIPS. Cayuga man arrested on child seduction charges. From Greencastle, a Cayuga man is facing allegations of sexual misconduct with a minor after an investigation by Indiana State Police. Zachary T. McBride, 36, Cayuga, faces felony charges of possession of child pornography, child seduction, and sexual battery, according to an Indiana State Police news release. ISP said it began an investigation after receiving information concerning allegations of child seduction and sexual battery. Police said that the investigation revealed McBride had allegedly communicated with the minor and provided funds and grocery items to receive child pornography from that minor. Vermilion County Circuit Court issued an arrest warrant on December 2nd, and Vermilion County Sheriff's Department arrested McBride on December 5th. He's being held in the Vermilion County Jail. Assisting agencies also included Susie's Place and the Vermilion County Prosecutor's Office. Williamsport teen arrested and charged in a multi-county chase. From Lafayette. A Williamsport, Indiana teenager led authorities on a multi-county chase before being captured after getting stuck in the snow on Friday night. According to a news release from Sergeant Jeremy Pierce of the Indiana State Police, Xander Wilson, 19, originally fled for the Lafayette Police Department. Then, just before 11:30 p.m. Eastern, ISP attempted to stop Wilson in his 2025 Honda Civic on State Road 25. Wilson continued crossing into Fountain County and Warren County before leaving the roadway and getting stuck in the snow at the intersection of County Road 1000 East and County Road 450 North in Warren County. Wilson was taken into custody. During the investigation, ISP Trooper Mitchell McKinney gathered information leading him to believe the driver was under the influence of a controlled substance. Wilson was transported to the Tippecanoe County Jail. Wilson has been charged with resisting law enforcement with a vehicle, a level 6 felony, operating a vehicle while intoxicated, endangerment, a class A misdemeanor, possession of marijuana, a class B misdemeanor, operating a vehicle under the influence of a controlled substance, a class C misdemeanor, reckless driving, a class C misdemeanor, and minor in possession of alcohol, a class C misdemeanor. McKinney was assisted by troopers from the Lafayette Post, the Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Office, the Fountain County Sheriff's Office, the Warren County Sheriff's Office, and the Lafayette Police Department. All suspects are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. And we looks like we have one obituary for today. William Dean Cox. William Dean Cox, 89, of Bismarck, Illinois, passed away at 2:48 a.m. on December 6th, 2025 at OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville. Dean was born on July 9, 1936. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 13, 2025, Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville at 3940 North Vermilion Street in Danville. James Bedoris will officiate. Burial will be at the Spring Hill Cemetery in Danville. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 13th at the funeral home. Memorials may be made in Dean's memory to the Bismarck First Church of Christ in Bismarck, Illinois. Please join Dean's family in sharing memories, photos, and videos of his life through his tribute wall at www.sunsetfuneralhome.com. And now from the opinion page by John Kroll, The Statehouse File, A Tale Full of Sound and Fury. So many idiocies abound, and there's so little time to point them out. The Indiana House of Representatives adopted its ill-conceived plan to redistrict the state's congressional maps mid-decade. If ever there was a solution in search of a problem, this is it. Apparently, Indiana's congressional maps, which were adopted less than 5 years ago by many of the same Republicans who say the districts now are an affront to justice, are an emergency that justifies the expense of calling the Indiana General Assembly into session in December. Other things, ever-increasing inflation, declining job creation, don't rise to emergency status because they affect only the lives of ordinary Hoosiers. But the need to rig the maps ahead of the 2026 midterm congressional elections is of critical importance to one person, President Donald Trump. Trump is terrified that a U.S. House of Representatives in Democrats' hands and armed with subpoena power will uncover evidence that during his second term, he's been running wild like that raccoon who got loose in a liquor store and whose antics went viral before the inebriated creature passed out. Because Trump is so scared, he does what he always does when he's under pressure. He tries to cheat. The author of the bill creating the new maps, Indiana Representative Ben Smaltz, Republican from Auburn, acknowledged as much when he said the redistricting was gerrymandering for partisan rather than racial reasons. That's significant for two reasons. The first is that Smaltz and his fellow Republicans already are creating a line of defense to meet the likelihood of a lawsuit should their maps clear the Indiana Senate. The courts have ruled that gerrymandering for political reasons is acceptable, but targeting minorities is not. Given that one of the focuses on Smaltz's bill is to remove the only black member of Indiana's congressional delegation, U.S. Representative Andre Carlson, Democrat of Indianapolis, who was reelected in 2024 with nearly 70% of the vote from office. There will be suspicion that racial considerations played a role in these deliberations. Those suspicions won't be tamped down by the determined refusal of Schmaltz and his fellow Republicans to adopt any amendments proposed by their Democratic colleagues to evaluate whether the new maps would disenfranchise minorities before adopting them. Democrats, it seems, can also play the legal maneuvering game. The other reason Schmaltz's admission matters is that it acknowledges exactly for whom he and his GOP colleagues work, a hint that first duty isn't to the people of Indiana. At the same time, Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita and the Indiana Secretary of State Diego Morales, both of whom spend almost as much time defending themselves against allegations that they've violated either ethics rules or the law as they do breathing, issued a hyperventilating press release. After an exhaustive study, these two deep thinkers reported that they'd found 165 non-citizens on Indiana's voter rolls, and that 21 of these non-citizens actually cast ballots. They crowed that they'd found massive evidence of voter fraud, even as critics charged they were engaged in a witch hunt. Hoosiers cast nearly 3 million ballots in 2024. Even if the results Rokita and Morales said they turned up were real, more on that in a second, that means the massive voter fraud accounted for 1/10,000th of the Indiana electorate. Wow, that number is almost subatomic. Even so, it matters because voter fraud is a crime and one that should be punished. I wonder if there's any way Indiana's Secretary of State, who oversees the state's elections, and Indiana's Attorney General, who enforces the state's laws and protects its interests, could figure out if there's a place where the veracity of their claims could be tested, and if there have been people voting in Indiana elections who shouldn't be, a place where the guilty could be held accountable for their crimes, like, say, a courtroom. Given that both Rokita and Morales treat the truth as if it were an infectious disease and put as much distance between them and, if they can, testing their claims in court, where things like evidence matter more than press releases do, it would go a long way to reassuring people that Indiana's Attorney General and Secretary of State aren't just bleeding more nonsense. Normally, idiocy in Indiana peaks during legislative sessions and election cycles. This year, though, we seem to be starting early. Lucky us. In this next opinion, Requiem for a Voting Scandal by Brian York. Nearly 4 years ago on January 18, 2022, I wrote about a frenzy that was sweeping the anti-Trump world. It had to do with a novel theory of the 2020 presidential election dispute. Here's the short version. Trump supporters in a few states, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Michigan, and New Mexico, were so brazen that in the days before the December 14, 2020, when the Electoral College voted to confirm former President Joe Biden's victory, they actually forged documents for falsely purporting that the Electoral College results for President Trump and sent them to the appropriate authorities in Washington and in their home states. They then planned to use the forgeries to steal the election on January 6, 2021. All the while, they hoped no one would notice. It was a crazy theory for a number of reasons discussed below, but the notion of so-called fake electors would not only resume resistance world, but it would spread among Democratic officials in the justice system and become a key part of the anti-Trump indictments of 2023 and 2024. Now it has all fallen apart. With a recent withdrawal of the case originally brought by the disgraced prosecutor Fannie Willis in Georgia, the theory that sparked so much excitement on the anti-Trump fringe is finally dead. What is remarkable is that the glaring flaws in the fake electors theory were obvious all along. It just took this long for the wheels of justice to turn. After Willis was taken off her own case following the disgrace of her top deputy, Georgia officials faced a daunting question. Who wants to pick up this prosecution and run with it? It turned out nobody did, and the case eventually ended up in the hands of the nonpartisan head of the Prosecuting Attorneys Council of Georgia, Peter Scandalakis. Last week, Scandalakis released a carefully argued 22-page memo supporting his decision to drop the Willis case altogether. As far as the fake electors theory is concerned, the substance of Scandalakis's discussion bore a striking resemblance to my column from January 2022. That's because the facts of the case have always been the facts of the case before and after the anti-Trump activists got so excited. First, Scandalakis explained that what the resistance calls fake electors were in fact contingent electors. In this way, in early December 2020, the Trump campaign was litigating the results of the election in Georgia, but the date was approaching, December 14th, on which the Electoral College would have to vote. Republicans were concerned that Biden's electors would be chosen on the 14th while the lawsuits were still pending. If Trump eventually won the litigation, he would then have zero electors. So, acting on the advice of the campaign's lawyers, the state Republican Party picked conditional Trump electors who could become real electors if and only if Trump won the lawsuit and was declared the winner of Georgia. They were contingent electors. Nothing in the evidence suggests that the contingent electors conspired to overturn the election, Scandalakis wrote. On the contrary, the record overwhelmingly demonstrates that the electors believe their actions were legally required to preserve Georgia's electoral votes. In the event, President Donald Trump prevailed in the then-pending lawsuit in Fulton County challenging the election. Scandalakis noted that the evidence also shows that the electors convened the meeting pursuant to the advice of counsel. Also, the contingent electors did their work in public. Back when the scandal was raging, MS Now's Rachel Maddow called the fake electors story a previously unknown, mysteriously coordinated effort to have Republicans in multiple states forge election documents after the last election and present themselves as fake electors to the Electoral College. In fact, the contingent electors announced their meeting. They invited the press to cover it. They tweeted about what they did. There were several news accounts about it, and they hired a court reporter to make a transcript of the proceedings, which proved extremely valuable to Scandalakis as they reviewed what happened. It's important to point out that all this was known at the time of the 2022 fake electors freakout. Even if Maddow could have known it, had she looked. Now, you could say the contingent electors were acting on pure faith when they did what they did. Certainly, there appeared to be no chance of Trump winning the litigation and thus winning Georgia. Indeed, that did not happen, but that does not mean the contingent electors had ill intent. It is not illegal to challenge election results, Scandalakis concluded. As a prosecutor, I am loath to use the criminal justice system to pursue law-abiding citizens who, in good conscience and upon the advice of counsel, were asked to perform certain tasks in connection with the litigation of an election. Fannie Willis knew all of this when she charged one of the contingent electors, then Georgia Republican Party Chairman David Schaefer, with a violation of the Georgia Racketeering RICO Act, impersonating a public officer, two counts of forgery in the first degree, three counts of false statements and writings, and five criminal attempt to commit filing false documents. Others face the same charges. The quote, fake electors prosecution was BS from the beginning, and now, at last, it's over. That was written by Brian Nork, who is a political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. This opinion is called Domestic Terrorism, quote, enters the Hoosier lexicon from Indianapolis. We are living through a volatile political environment these days, and a troubling phrase that has re-entered the Hoosier lexicon is this, domestic terrorism. Since last summer, when President Donald Trump pressed the Indiana GOP to forge new congressional maps, about a dozen Republicans in the Indiana Senate have been swatted when local law enforcement is called to a residence after a phantom crime has been reported. Others have received pipe bomb threats at their homes and businesses. Very disappointed in Indiana State Senate Republicans led by Rhino Senators Rod Bray and Greg Good for not wanting to redistrict their state, allowing the United States Congress to perhaps gain two more Republican seats, Trump said in a late November social media post. Threats of intimidation subsequently cascaded in. There was Senator Ron Alting, whose former Lafayette home was swatted. This was a false threat intended to cause fear and disrupt the lives of innocent people, Alting said. Regardless of the motive, it's dangerous and irresponsible, and it puts families and first responders at risk. Senator Mike Bohachik's family was threatened on November 28th at their Michiana Shores home. This recent pattern of threatening behavior and intimidation attempts are not only concerning but also illegal, he said in a statement. Senator Jean Lysing received a pipe bomb threat at her Oldenburg home. I believe these threats are a result of the redistricting pressure in Indiana, Lysing said in a statement. Threats like this to a public officials are unacceptable. And I need to stop right there. That's the end of our time today. I hope you have a good day today. This is Kathy wishing you the best for Tuesday, the 9th of December.